I'm Rob Kirkup, and this is How Haunted, the paranormal podcast where each episode we explore the horrible history and terrifying ghost stories of one of the scariest places on the planet. In episode 77, you join me in the remote countryside of Northumberland, and I literally mean join me, as I recorded this episode on location at the site of the bloodiest battle in the history of England. This loss of life, a little over 500 years ago, appears to have left its mark on this land, as the sights and sounds of battle, and of death, are experienced here all too often. Join me as together we ask, just how haunted is Flodden Field? Listener discretion is advised, as each episode of How Haunted will feature gruesome tales, horrific happenings, bloody murder, and ghosts. So many ghosts. Listen on if you dare. You join me on a spring afternoon in the remote Northumberland countryside. I'd love to say that the weather's been kind to me today, but of course, it's awful. It's windy. Hopefully you won't be able to hear just how windy it is, as I've got a windscreen on my microphone. The sky is ominously black, and it's spitting currently, but I expect a downpour before long. It's been raining pretty heavily for the last few days, and the country lanes that I drove along to get here are largely flooded. And the muddy field that I'm stood in right now is a quagmire. But as you'll hear, that might be wholly appropriate given the history of this location. In the 20 minutes or so that I've already been here, I've not seen another living soul, and mine is the only car in the small car park, so I am completely alone. The only sounds I've heard is the constant birdsong that you'll no doubt hear throughout, and the occasional bang of a shotgun somewhere relatively close, but then we are in the countryside. There's a school of thought that ghosts remain at a location when a person loses their life in a traumatic manner. There's little surprise then that there are battlefields all over the world believed to be haunted due to the manner in which the countless deaths occurred. Northumberland is no exception, and right now I'm stood at the Flodden Monument, which was erected in 1910. This is a monument to the greatest loss of life seen in any battle to ever take place on English soil. The Battle of Flodden Field. A little over 500 years ago in this very field, which will have been largely the same then as it is today, 14,000 men were slain here in the space of just 3 hours. With such a huge loss of life in unimaginable circumstances, it's no surprise that there have been reports of strange happenings at the site of the battle ever since. The Battle of Flodden Field, also known as the Battle of Branxton, took place on the 9th of September 1513, between an invading Scottish army under the command of King James IV and an English army led by Thomas Howard. It was both the last medieval and first modern British battle. It was the last medieval because the longbow played an active part for the final time in a battle, and the first modern because it began, as you'll soon hear, with an exchange of artillery fire. On the 22nd of August, a Scottish army of 80,000 men crossed the River Tweed at Coldstream and entered England. On their way to the battle, the Scottish army had laid siege to and burned the castles of Norham, Ark and Etal. The Scots then conquered Ford Castle, which became their headquarters. King James decided to spend a few days here, with many of his men deciding to head back to Scotland with stolen livestock. Lady Ford fell for the charm of the king, and occupied most of his time while he was at the castle. While the Scottish were at Ford Castle, the English were heading north in readiness for the battle. Thomas Howard, the Earl of Surrey, set up his headquarters at Pontefract Castle at the beginning of August. By the end of that month he was in Newcastle upon Tyne, alongside his army. On September the 3rd they arrived at Alnwick Castle in Northumberland, where the Earl was joined by the Lord Admiral, who had brought over 1,000 men from his fleet to join the English army, which now numbered around 25,000 in all. Eventually the fateful day arrived. The weather was terrible, it was misty, and the rain fell heavily. The two armies now stood almost a mile apart, separated by a stretch of boggy ground known as Branxton Moor. The Scots were positioned at the top of Branxton Hill, looking down at the English position below them at the foot of the hill. The two sides were fairly evenly numbered, but there was no doubt that the Scottish were at a huge advantage given their position. Their artillery was also of a higher calibre than the guns available to the English. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the battle began, as both sides opened fire with their artillery. The English got the better of this exchange, with the Scottish gunmen looking cumbersome and inaccurate. King James identified a weakness in the English right wing, a section of men from Lancashire and Cheshire under Edmund Howard, who looked unorganised. James ordered the Scottish left wing to attack, and they charged down the hill. The majority of Edmund's men fled, leaving the brave soldiers who remained to be quickly cut down. Lord Dacre and some English borderers took up the fight with the Scottish left. They quickly received added support and fought to keep the Scottish at bay. The English right wing was very close to collapse, and it was only saved when Thomas Howard ordered a cavalry charge to the Scottish left. This persuaded the Scottish left to fall back, after which they decided they had played their part in the battle, and they fled to safety. King James was excited by the scene unfolding before him, and he was keen to get involved in the battle. He led the Scottish centre charge down the hill towards the English centre, being led by the Earl of Surrey. The English centre stood their ground as the Scots roared defiantly as they charged down the hill towards them. However, the Scottish lost their momentum as they reached the bottom of the hill, as they found themselves crossing marshy, boggy ground. The English seized the initiative and engaged them in combat. The central column of Scots were largely armed with 18-foot-long pikes, somewhat bulky and heavy weapons, usually meant for use against cavalry. These proved to be completely ineffective when faced with infantry armed with billhooks, who simply chopped the heads off the pikes, turning them into ineffective wooden poles. The decision by King James to leave the advantageous position at the top of the hill was to prove the turning point of the battle. The English strategy was far superior, and after much manoeuvring, the main body of the remnants of the Scottish army was now surrounded. Gradually, the English hacked them down, until only a handful of spearmen remained defending their king. They were quickly dispatched, leaving only a few desperate nobles standing, before they too joined the thousands of corpses on Branxton Moor. Over 10,000 Scots lost their life at Flodden during the battle. This is in stark contrast to the estimated fatalities of the English, which range from just 400 to 4,000. Amongst the Scottish killed that day was King James IV himself. He was the last British monarch to be killed in battle. He was joined amongst the Scottish dead by 9 earls, 14 lords of parliament, the Archbishop of St Andrews, as well as dozens of chieftains, nobles, and knights. The following morning, Border Reavers looted the dead, taking valuables and weapons. The bodies of the dead were thrown into 2 large pits. Most of the bodies were thrown into a deep pit at the site of the battle, and the remaining were thrown into a pit in the churchyard of Branxton, which I can see from where I'm stood. Somewhere in this field where I am stood, there's a pit which has been lost for over 500 years, which contains the corpses of several thousand who died that day. Where it is in the field, nobody knows. But it really makes you think. Thomas Dacre, the second Lord Baron Dacre of Gilsland, discovered the body of King James IV on the battlefield. He later wrote that the Scots love me worst of any Englishman living, by reason that I found the King of the Scots. The chronicle writer John Stowe gave a location for the King's death, Pipard's Hill. The location of this is now unknown, but historians suggest that it may be in the small hill on Branxton Ridge overlooking Branxton Church. Dacre then took the body to Berwick upon Tweed, where according to Hall's Chronicle, it was viewed by the captured Scottish courtiers, William Scott and John Foreman, who acknowledged that it was the king. The body was embalmed and then taken from York, which was a city that James had promised to capture before Michaelmas, to Newcastle upon Tyne. It was then taken to Sheen Priory near London. James's banner, sword, and the armour that he wore that day was taken to the Shrine of St Cuthbert at Durham Cathedral. Much of the armour of the Scottish casualties was sold on the field, and 350 suits of armour were taken in Nottingham Castle. A list of horses taken at the field runs to 24 pages long. There are a number of legends that surround the body of the fallen king. It's widely believed that King James IV's body was buried at Lanercost Priory, but there may be a much more gruesome reality. It's been suggested that his body was disemboweled and sent to London. His body was kept in the Monastery of Sheen, and then moved into a storage room. Years later, it was discovered by workmen who cut off the head and used it as a macabre plaything. It was passed from one English noble to another for years, until it was finally buried in an anonymous grave. There's even a number of theories that suggest that the king didn't actually die at the battle. These suggestions began the month after the battle, as a Scottish merchant claimed to have spoke with him in October. Robert Lindsay of Pitscotty, who was a Scottish chronicler and author of the History and Chronicles of Scotland 1436 to 1565, which was the first history of Scotland to be composed in Scots rather than Latin. He recorded that the king escaped Flodden Field, made it back north of the border, but was killed somewhere between Duns and Kelso. Similarly, John Leslie, who was a Scottish Roman Catholic bishop and historian, wrote 60 years after the battle that the body taken to England was actually My Lord Bonhard, and he too writes that James was seen in Kelso after the battle, but he says that he wasn't killed. Instead, he went on pilgrimage in far nations. George Buchanan, who was a Scottish historian and humanist scholar, wrote in the 16th century that James IV had escaped the field, leaving his squire of attendants, Alexander Elphinstone, 1st Lord Elphinstone, to fight on, and that it was Elphinstone's body that the English mistook for the king, due to him being clothed in royal insignia and his stature being similar to that of King James IV. A paranormal belief crept in when it was suggested that the king had been warned against invading England by supernatural powers. On the eve of the battle, he was praying at St Michael's Kirk at Linlithgow in West Lothian, and the church doors swung open and a young man walked towards him. The king looked on in astonishment at what the man was wearing. He had a blue robe which seemed to move all on its own, sandals, and a scarlet sash around his waist. His blonde hair flowed behind him, and the king was convinced he was in the presence of an angel. The angel, who the chroniclers of the time can't decide upon, as some say it was St John and others say St Michael, marched straight past the king's entourage, and when he was mere inches from the king, he looked him in the eye and told him that he had been sent by none other than the Virgin Mary herself. This was to command him to not go into battle, for if he did, the Scots would lose, and many of their number, including the king himself, would die. The mother of Jesus forbid the king from crossing the border into England. He must stay in Scotland. Not only this, but he should be wary of taking the counsel of women. This appears to be in reference to Mary Tudor, Queen of France, who had personally asked James to invade England, even given her a ring from her own finger as a token of their allegiance. With the message delivered, the figure turned and walked out of the church. The king was shaken and had told many people of what he had been told in the church. But as we know only too well, he paid it no heed. The Scots marched to Flodden Field. Paolo Giovio was an Italian physicist, historian and biographer, and in 1549 he wrote an account that claimed that three other bad omens preceded the battle. When James was in council at the camp at Flodden, a hare ran out of his tent, and when his knights attempted to stop the beast, it evaded their weapons. Mice were discovered to have gnawed away the strings and buckle of the king's helmet, and on the morning of the battle itself, his tent was speckled with dew, and the dew was the colour of blood. Ever since the battle, there have been frequent reports of the ghostly sounds of the battle coming from the field, the clash of swords, the sound of horses, and the screams and groans of the dying soldiers. These sounds are still heard by the locals to this very day, especially in the dead of night. The A697 road nearby has been the location of sightings of phantom soldiers crossing the road. In the 1700s, two brothers swore they saw the entire battle being refought. When questioned about it afterwards, they could describe precisely what happened. They could explain what people looked like, and they could describe in great detail what was on the banners. On the 30th of July 2005, almost 19 long years ago, I came to Flodden Field after dark, accompanied by my brother Tom and our good friend Ryan Elwell. This is the report that I wrote at the time about that night. We arrived in the Flodden Field car park at 9:15 after an hour-long drive. Since it was a summer's night and it was still fairly light, we chose to leave our torches in the car and head into the field to have a look around where we could still see without artificial light, so he'd have a better idea once it got dark. There is a large monument at Flodden Field, and there is the battlefield trail going around the field, with large informative boards scattered along the route. No sooner had we entered the field than we heard a loud noise coming from behind us that made us all jump. It was a cow in the field across the road, making a sound that I've never heard a cow make before. We made our way up to the monument and took some photos and admired the view around us. I've been to Flodden before, so I explained the planned route for our investigation. To fully appreciate this place, you have to stop and think about what happened here all those years ago. Somewhere in this field, several thousand dead bodies are buried in a pit. We walked downhill along a track to where most of the 14,000 killed will have lost their lives. We read the informative board at the lowest point, and Ryan pointed out the Scots' major downfall. "Look at the pikes the Scots were carrying," he said. 5.5 metres long. All the English needed to do was sidestep their attack and give it to them. If only King James IV had had super tactician Ryan on his side. We walk to the right here, and there are three very ruined, very creepy farmhouses. Tom took some photos, and on two of them there are orbs at more or less exactly the same place above one of the buildings. Looking through the viewfinder, it wasn't the moon or something in the sky, but it had been raining solid for 3 days. Thankfully it had stopped raining earlier in the evening, but with orbs, especially outside, it will have almost certainly have been some form of precipitation hanging in the air. Or maybe an insect. This was a summer's night after all. At roughly the same time we were discussing this, Ryan registered a max reading of 10 on my EMF meter. No sooner had it went to max, than there was nothing there at all. It went back down to zero, and I heard that familiar tick, tick, tick. I found this unusual as there are no power sources around, and there are no readings at any point in the field. It was now 10 o'clock and it was starting to get darker, so we decided to retrieve our torches from the mystery machine, as I sometimes would rather embarrassingly call my car at the time, which was a lovely gold Toyota Yaris. On our way back we heard a loud noise come from near the car park. It was that cow again. "That cow must be getting a right good saying to by the sound of it," said Ryan. I had to agree. We collected our torches and a night vision video camera and retraced our steps to the monument. From here we split into two teams. Ryan and Tom went down the hill on the left hand side of the field, and I went down the right hand path we'd taken earlier. Quite a few people have reported hearing whispers coming from the hedgerows, so this seemed to be the best way to maximise our chances of experiencing something for ourselves. I reached the bottom first, so I sat on a stone bench and waited for the others. I sat in silence, listening for anything strange, but I heard nothing whatsoever. Tom and Ryan arrived shortly afterwards, and the three of us made our way through the gate, and this time we went left, following the battlefield trail. Halfway along, Tom's torch went off. He carried on walking, and it came back on. So we doubled back, and it went off again at exactly the same spot. There were no readings on the EMF meter. We carried on walking and reached another gate. There was a signpost saying viewpoint, pointing up the steep Piper's Hill, so we decided to go that way. I was at the back, and I'd not felt scared at all during this investigation. But now I had this feeling that I couldn't shift, that somebody was behind me, following me. I was constantly turning around expecting somebody or something to be right behind me. I hadn't said anything, but the other two both seemed a little bit more jumpy now than they had been earlier. Tom was talking about expecting to see a spectral version of the Scottish troops charging down the hill towards us. All of a sudden Ryan stopped in his tracks and turned around and whispered, "Did you hear that?" I'd heard nothing, but he said a voice came from directly behind me. He said the voice sounded like it said, "Oi." But we hadn't seen another person at all since we'd arrived here over an hour and a half earlier. Could this have been a spirit? Perhaps it was an animal, or maybe it was Ryan's imagination. We stopped, and we sat in silence on a bench midway up the hill. We asked for some kind of sign that we weren't alone, but nothing happened. Sadly. By the time we reached the bottom of the slope it was 11:30, and we walked towards the ruined farm buildings again. I heard a loud bang, then another. I stopped dead in my tracks. "Shotgun," said Ryan. "In the dark," was my response. "Maybe they give them headlamps," was his explanation. Retrospectively, it could have been absolutely anything, but it did make us take notice, as we were out in the middle of nowhere, and if somebody was shooting in the dark, we'd be sitting ducks. We got at the ruined buildings again, and we split up to have a wander around. Nothing happened, and it was now after midnight, so we decided to go back to the monument for a short while, and then call it a night. As we walked back through the field towards the monument, the EMF meter registered a max reading again for the briefest of moments. We asked out for some kind of sign that we weren't alone, but nothing happened, other than a rustle in the hedgerow that will have almost certainly been an animal. Nothing happened on our final return to the monument, and we headed back to the car park and headed home. At the time I summed up by saying, "This place is amazing, probably the most historically significant place I've ever investigated, and I think I set my hopes a little too high. I will definitely return, and here I am almost 19 years later, and this time I'm all alone. Seemingly there's nobody for miles around, just me and you keeping me company." On that night, nothing too significant happened, for us anyway. That cow was having the time of its life. But that wasn't the case when Tracy Burns of Selkirk, on the Scottish side of the Scottish borders, came to Flodden on the 9th of September 2013, on the 500th anniversary of the battle. She emailed me in early 2014 to tell me what happened to her. I've written a couple of books about Northumberland since, but this is the first time that Tracy's story has been told in any kind of media. I came south of the border to pay my respects for all of the Scottish lives lost that day, as there is a monument in Selkirk where I live which celebrates the only survivor of the 70 men from Selkirk who fought in the battle. It was a Monday and I'd taken the day off work. It's only an hour's drive, so I was there around midday. I parked up in the little car park and was moved to see the monument atop the hill surrounded by huge Scottish flags, and a bit of a gathering had formed. I'd come along on my own, but everybody was chatting to one another, and I was immediately made to feel part of the group. We were united in a common interest. We were guided on a walk along the route of the battlefield that started at 3:30 in the afternoon. It was very emotional, as we walked the route of the horrendous battle 500 years ago to the hour. An older lady I'd been talking to fell to the ground in tears. It all became too much for her. In the evening, at around 7 o'clock, the Selkirk Royal and Ancient Borough Ex-Standard Bearers Association from my hometown rode through the area. It was my turn to cry. I stayed overnight in the area, eating and drinking with a lot of the others who'd been at the battlefield for the day's celebrations. They weren't all Scottish, it was predominantly Scots, but there was a mixture of English there too. There was even an American couple who'd been in Northumberland on vacation and heard about the 500th anniversary, so came along. We had a great night, and we drank a toast to all of the fallen on that day. Everybody in the pub joined in. Even those who weren't part of the group raised their glass. It was a lovely moment. The following morning I got up early, at around 5 o'clock. I had to get back to Selkirk for 8 a.m. for work. I was up and ready to go out by 6. I decided to drive back past Flodden Field on my way home, since I had plenty of time. There was a fine mist hanging over the ground, and it was quiet. The streets and the roads were deserted. However, I was stunned to look over towards Flodden Field as I was driving past and see dozens of people spread out, walking through the field slowly, looking down. Some were on all fours crawling around. I wondered what was going on, so I parked up in the little car park, and I was surprised that there were no other cars there with so many people already here at the field. I got out, and I was surprised by how quiet it was. Compared to the constant chatter of the day before, there was lots of people here, but nobody seemed to be saying a word. I realised I'd left my phone in the car, so doubled back, leant in to retrieve it, got out and locked the car up again. But there was nobody here now. The field was empty. There'd been, I think, 40 or 50 people here, not 30 seconds earlier. I walked to where the monument was and looked all around. I couldn't see anybody. I thought maybe they'd gone over the other side of the hill, although I knew that was impossible based on where these people had been only a moment earlier. But there was nobody there. Nobody anywhere. I was alone, and I was suddenly terrified. I pretty much ran all the way back to the car and headed home. The battlefield was looted by Border Reavers early in the morning the day after the battle. This was exactly 500 years before I'd seen all of those people in the field. All of those people who just disappeared. Mm-hmm. You can follow How Haunted on Twitter at @HowHauntedPod or over on the Instagram at @HowHauntedPod. If you want to get in touch, you can do so by visiting the website at www.how-haunted.com, or you can email me directly at rob@how-haunted.com. If you'd like to support the show, you can sign up to one of three Patreon tiers. They start at as little as £1. You can get early ad-free access to episodes and a monthly bonus episode where I conduct a paranormal investigation, talking you through the history, the ghost stories, and what happened on the night itself. This is interspersed with actual audio from the ghost hunt, so you can hear what happened as it happened. What's more, there's a free 7-day trial to the £3 tier, so you could get access right now to April's Patreon special, which is another on-location episode of Preston Tower in Northumberland. Then there are all of the other special episodes, which include the big Halloween special at the Golden Fleece in York, the Dean Court Hotel, Dalhousie Castle Hotel, the York Dungeon, Bedlam Theatre, the Lytton Phil, the 4-hour version of my investigation at the Bowes Railway Museum, Kielder Castle, and the 48 hours I spent in the company of a haunted doll. You can also get yourself some exclusive How Haunted merch, including a mug and a t-shirt. Find out more at patreon.com/howhauntedpod. If you'd like to support the show but you aren't a fan of Patreon, why not donate a couple of pounds to help with the admin side of the podcast? You can do this at buymeacoffee.com/howhauntedpod. All the information and links are in the podcast episode description. If you've enjoyed this episode, then please consider leaving a review on your podcast provider of choice. It really does help other people to find How Haunted. Next time out, we head to a jail dating from 1756, where suffering, disease, murder, suicide, and executions occurred all too often, resulting in the ghosts that now roam the ancient corridors and cells. You'll hear from the owner of the building as we discuss the haunted heritage of the old jail, his personal beliefs as to what ghosts are, if they exist, and his time appearing in over 120 episodes of a hugely popular British paranormal TV show. Join me next episode as I am joined by Richard Felix, and we ask, just how haunted is Derby Jail? Thank you so much for accompanying me for our paranormal adventures once again. Stay safe, and join me next time, where we once again ask the question, how haunted?